Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Thanks for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Reflex Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined today by Kevin Cassis, coach of the Lehigh Mountain Hawks, who was in Charlotte, North Carolina, with the ESPNU crew all weekend long, and we are talking about quarterfinal weekend. You know, Coach, this was an awesome weekend of lacrosse action, and I know that you were in the studio. It's got to be one of those kind of marathon-type sessions of watching lacrosse and being on TV, and I know that it wasn't your first time, but good experience this time around?
Absolutely. First of all, thanks for having me, and second of all, yeah, it was an awesome experience. I'll just tell you from my point of view, I feel like we're in very good hands when it comes to the television media aspect of our sport. Just kind of watching behind the scenes, the folks at ESPN, their leader John Vassallo is their head producer, for lacrosse. He does a great job, and there's so many people involved, and they're all pros, all professionals in what they do. And for me to go into that environment and learn about that side of the business is a really valuable experience. So, yeah, absolutely. It was a lot of fun, a little bit easier the second time around. First time is a little bit of a learning experience. Second time, just kind of seamlessly worked in there. And, it also helps when you have, two absolute professionals in Anish Shroff and Mark Dixon. So just kind of feed off of those guys, and they won't steer you wrong.
Two things before we move on to the games. First is, it looked like you got a little cleaned up up top. Did you get a haircut specifically for being on TV all weekend?
Absolutely, absolutely. You got to clean up a little bit when you go onto the big screen. It was, I just remember going in last time and said, all right, well, I need to make sure I take a page out of the J.J. Threads book and clean myself up a little bit, and made sure I did that before I went down. So it. Yeah, it was good. Cleaned myself up, made sure I was looking good for TV, and put my best foot forward.
Right on. You looked the part for sure. And then the second one is, and we saw Dixon struggle with it a little bit between the two games on Sunday. How intimidating is the touchscreen?
The touchscreen is really hard. I think the guys behind the scenes, they like to play some pranks every now and again, so I got a feeling they were messing with Dixon a little bit. And I was excited because last year, they threw a couple rookie pranks at me as I was going through it, so they didn't get me this time around. So I think I'm building a little bit of a rep down there, and they're okay with that.
No doubt. I'm sure that you would have made them run if they had pulled that one out again. But I got to say, I applaud any effort to prank Mark Dixon.
Absolutely. I think we all do.
Excellent. Well, let's talk about Saturday first. It's a couple days removed now. It was a little bit of an opportunity to process it. And, starting with, Cornell's 16-6 win over Ohio State, my reaction was that, Cornell played well. I don't think they played their best game that they have, but they certainly played well both offensively and defensively. Jumped all over Ohio State. I think that they had a 10-2 lead, either at halftime or shortly before. And, kind of when it came down to it, I thought that Ohio State played as poorly as they have in over a month, in my opinion, and I really thought it was kind of the only performance like that outside of the first quarter for Denver. And I don't necessarily know where to kind of put it at the feet of, but I guess what I'm trying to get at is I don't think a 10-goal separation between these two teams would be all that common if they were to play, an extended series. And I thought, defensively, particularly early, and Coach Myers talked about this post-game, they didn't do some things that they wanted to do, and, I thought that to a degree, their plan just didn't work out the way they wanted to, particularly, a lot of people had talked about the need to pressure Rob Pinnell and make sure that he's uncomfortable, and it didn't seem like that was a huge priority defensively. And then at the other end of the field, and this is where I really thought they were, kind of pushed back on their heels, was, it was one of those days, and I'm sure you've been a part of this, where it wasn't as if I thought that they weren't able to make the plays. My impression of what happened to Ohio State offensively is they had so many of those passes that they weren't sky-mailing it out of bounds. It was, passes to a guy who was kind of holding his stick back to put himself into a catch and shoot position or a catch and a face dodge position, and it just bounced off the top of, you know, the scoop of his stick and out of bounds. And to me, you know, that's just so symbolic for it's not our day. And I thought that there were other aspects of that as well. What was your reaction to that game, and do you think I'm kind of on point in that characterization?
I do. I think both sides of it, you know, for me, that was probably, you know, one of the games that I was most looking forward to on the weekend, and, you know, I guess most of all because it was the first one on tap. And, you know, for us sitting there in a studio kind of watching that game, we were shocked. And you know, not shocked because Cornell was playing so well, and not shocked because Ohio State was playing so poorly, but just shocked in how the game was going. And I thought that game was won or lost in the first quarter. And, you know, it's tough to say that. I mean, that doesn't happen very often in our sport. You know, typically it's a marathon, not a sprint. But, you know, Cornell came out sprinting in the first quarter. I mean, they won 6 of 8 faceoffs. I thought that was a huge, huge key for them. Doug Tesoriero was on fire, and he was very impressive. And, you know, the shot total was 12-2. You know, Ohio State, 2 shots and a quarter. I can't imagine that's happened very much for those guys this year. And, you know, the field was just tilted in Cornell's direction, you know, all quarter long. And you look at it, you go to the first break, first time to catch your breath if you're Ohio State, and you're already down 6-1. And I just felt like it was that was like an insurmountable task to try and come back from that. And, you know, I thought the first possession, you know, ended up not being very telling for the game. But, you know, Cornell comes down, and Rob Pennell's working on Joe Maurer down there. And, you know, Maurer gets him. You know, he turns the ball over. It was just one-on-one defense. There was no slide. There was nothing else. And, you know, he takes the ball away from him. I said, wow, you know, maybe this is their plan. They're just going to D him up and let him get after him. But, you know, as it turned out, that wasn't the way it worked out, you know. And I thought, you know, Cornell did a nice job against Ohio State's defense. You know, they tried a whole bunch of things against Cornell. You know, they tried some zone, they tried some quick sliding man, they tried no slide, and I think they mixed it up so much that they didn't really feel comfortable on defense either. And when you're not comfortable against Rob Pennell and Steve Mock and the rest of that crew, you're going to give up a lot of goals. And as you can see, you know, you give up 11 in the first half, and that's the ball game. On the other side, you know, you watch Ohio State. You know, I think they just had the ball so few times that they started pressing. And, you know, for their offense, you know, we played against them in the fall. You know, we had Ohio State was out in the San Francisco Classic, and, you know, they can sling the ball around, and they will sling the ball around. You know, they'll throw to guys that are you know, open by an inch inside. And sometimes it looks incredible, and sometimes, you know, it turns into the turnovers left and right. And that's kind of how it happened in the beginning of the game. And they didn't have the ball very much. They were misfiring a little bit on offense, and, you know, their possessions were squeezed down. So, you know, they just you just kind of look at it in a microscope and say, just not their day. Well, it's tough to do that when you just don't have the ball. So I thought overall a dominating effort by Cornell in the first half, especially. You know, they were able to just kind of put it in cruise control in the second half and move on. So, very impressed on both ends of the field by Cornell. I thought Ohio State had an awesome season. I thought, you know, they came a long way. I actually texted Coach Nick Myers, who's become a friend of mine in the coaching world, and, you know, where they have come from when we saw them back in October to this point, you know, not including this game. Obviously, that, you know, nobody wants to end on a 16-6 loss, but I thought they made major strides, and he did a heck of a job coaching, as did his staff.
Yeah, I there's not a whole lot in there that I could disagree with. Just to kind of build off of it a little bit, you know, one thing I wanted to, you know, kind of give special shine to, and obviously Steve Mock putting up 7 goals, you know, it's not going to be something that's going to get lost you know, many people's kind of perspective. But, you know, the fact that he opened the scoring 32 seconds in, then he had three goals in about a minute and a half in the middle of the first quarter. So he had four goals with 5 minutes to go in the first quarter. I mean, you know, it's the type of job. And I was talking to, you know, a professional coach yesterday who, you know, kind of, I think, watched Steve Mock with a little bit of a different eye toward, you know, kind of what his skill set is. And, you know, we were comparing him to some other finishers. And, you know, I think he kind of said, you know, his point was he kind of reminded him of Kevin Lavelle. And you know, I said, I don't know if I totally see that, because there are aspects of his athleticism that come into play and his ability to find space and, you know, catch and finish that remind me a lot more of a guy like Zach Greer, who was, you know, kind of like a really impressive physical prowess. And, you know, whatever the case is and whatever your view is on the type of game that Steve Mock plays, you know, both he and Rapinoe postgame were, you know, very kind of, deferential to each other and how dependent they're, you know, success is on the other, and certainly that, you know, makes a lot of sense and goes a long way. And then the last thing I wanted to kind of mention, Cornell, offensively, you know, Connor Busick has really emerged as just, you know, an unbelievable number one midfield option. And you know, I'm sure that this is something that, you know, you can speak to pretty well, but when you have that type of weapon in your arsenal and other teams have to prepare for it, it just makes it so either both much more difficult because it is so many teams' primary option, but when you can do it successfully, it suggests how much better you are than the average. And to have three goals and two assists against Ohio State, you know, after they had played, you know, midfielders like Cam Flint a week prior, Davis Butts 2 days before that, you know, it suggests a lot, you know, not only about the day he had, but the type of player he's becoming. And, you know, for a guy who, you know, had a pretty, you know, pretty rocky freshman year, coming in with a lot of expectations out of Cincinnati after making the U19 team, it's been a really impressive jump to see Connor Busick make.
Absolutely. I'll speak to your first point, first, which was on, Steve Mock. And yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, what he's doing is incredibly impressive. And, you know, seven goals that he put up there, you know, he, you know, a lot of people don't know this fact. And, you know, I was just kind of looking at Cornell, you know, over the course of the year, watching, you know, how their offense has performed. You know, they've only scored in single digits on one occasion this year. They lost to Bucknell 9-8 right around midseason. And that was the only game of the year that Steve Mock didn't play. You know, so every time that kid's in the lineup, it is a fact that they score in double digits and they score a lot. And, you know, they're just a different team with him in there, obviously. So, you know, look at that. I think, you know, definitely more Zach Greer than Kevin Lavelle. Obviously two guys that I know really well. You know, I've coached Zach Greer. I have played alongside Kevin Lavelle, and I see more Greer than I do Lavelle. But at the end of the day, you know, what do all three of those guys have in common? They put the ball in the back of the net. And, you know, I was sitting there, I'm obviously, you know, I'm an assistant coach with Team USA. You know, we're getting ready here with Coach Mead, Coach Petromala, Coach Tambroni to, you know, start getting ready for tryouts, which are going to be next fall. And we're sitting here thinking about, you know, who are the best inside finishers in the game, whether it be college or professional. And, you know, it's tough to come up with, and I would challenge anyone to do this, you know, who are the best American finishers around? And, you know, you think about the college teams, you think about some of the professional teams, it seems like, including Lehigh, you have Canadians. And there's not a lot of American finishers in there. You know, Steve Mock has developed himself into one of the best American finishers, inside players, catch-and-shoot guys that I've seen in a while. The other guy that comes to mind is Jack Rice at Villanova. Beyond that, I'm not sure. I'm not sure who it is. So I've been impressed with Mock and what he's been able to do. Obviously, it helps having a Pinnell back there who can get you the ball at any given point and can stretch the defense and force slides. So those two guys, you know, I've affectionately been called Batman and Robin, and I can see why. You know, they remind me a lot of the Danowski Greer combo that I coached, you know, back in 2006, 2007.
Yeah,
at that point, you're looking at – yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, just to throw one more name in the mix as far as a guy who's really emerged to the pro ranks after having an incredible college season. I think Chris Bocklet might be able to catch some Rob Pinnell passes and turn him back around. So I would imagine that he's going to want to throw his hat in the ring for the U.S. team in 2014.
Yep, good. That's a good one. I like that one. And
just do. I mean, I'm just trying to help you out. Make your job easier.
We can use all the help we can get. It's, you know, we're going to have to put up some numbers against the Canadians. They obviously got guys that can put the ball in the back of the net. So,
no question. And you know, if this were 2 or 3 years ago, you know, one of the finishers that we would be talking about, you know, on Syracuse's sidelines would be Stephen Keough. But, you know, the fact of the matter was, you know, moving on to the second game on Saturday, it just didn't seem like this was a Syracuse team that was going to be able to manufacture goals against this Yale defense. And, you know, depending on your opinions of Yale, and I think that that's kind of the most important thing that, it's the most impactful lens through which you can look at this game. And it's my opinion of Yale that they're an excellent, excellent team. And over the course of the last 3 weeks, you know, I've found myself saying, and I think I've said this on, you know, other podcasts or other places, that a lot of the things I was saying to myself about Yale were similar to the things that I was saying to myself about Loyola last year. You know, things such as, wow, they really can create offense in a number of different ways. But primarily, it was how well they control the ball, and obviously tremendous credit to Dylan Lovings and his wings for their ability to do that. And then primarily, I think it was how they were able to defend, how they were able to go, you know, straight up with, you know, I think whether it was McCormick or Peter Johnson or, you know, some of their short sticks, just so impressive in their ability to turn back consistently, frustrate, you know, Syracuse's offense and create action the other way. I thought that they were very ferocious on ball and in support, and that's a huge skill, I think, to get, you know, college teams not only on the same page and executing the same way in a certain set, but also doing it with a tremendous amount of energy and a tremendous amount of ferocity. And I thought that the Yale staff did a nice job with that. And particularly after they settled down, you know, after falling behind 4-0, and I gotta say, I missed the first two goals because I was in post game for the first game, but, you know, it kind of seemed like, even when they were giving up the next two goals, you know, a lot of people had made mention of the fact that Yale had come back against Penn State, and certainly that was very pertinent. You know, it seemed like they weren't panicking. You know, when Andy Shea called a timeout, I think after the third goal, you know, he got zoomed in on by the TV cameras, and it was like, okay, he's upset and frustrated, but he's not freaking out, and it doesn't look like this game, he's afraid that this game's gonna get away from his team, and ultimately, you know, that ended up being the case. And so, you know, as Yale offensively started to chip away over the course of the next, you know, quarter and a half to bring it to 4-4, and then ultimately when they were able to put in the next two to go ahead 6-4, I just thought that they had done a masterful job of controlling the game, you know, making what they wanted to have happen, you know, and I thought that Eric Metalli, his four saves in the second quarter were really, really big to make sure that, you know, Yale was able to sustain momentum, because they were only going to go into the half down 4-2 after a big first quarter goal with 4 seconds to go, I think, changed momentum. But then ultimately, you know, and I've said this a few times, and I hope that it doesn't sound trite, but the fact of the matter is that, you know, if you're going to try to play, if you're going to try to win the mental game against Syracuse, you need to do it really, really well, because you're not just playing against guys like Luke Kometty, Kevin Rice, and Dylan Donahue, and JoJo Marasco. You are playing against Syracuse in a very real way, you know, and I think that this is something that D3 lacrosse fans noted when it came to, you know, Stephen and Salisbury playing against each other. For 5 years, you know, it was pretty clear that Stevenson had been playing against Salisbury, you know, with a capital S and a capital L, you know, all that sort of thing. I don't know. I felt like when Syracuse was able to make plays in the last 3 minutes, you know, whether it be those three goals that allowed them to come back from a two-goal deficit and take a lead, or, you know, what was a tie game preserving save out of Dom Lamolinara, it just seemed like Syracuse. And, you know, I don't know what your opinion is of that, because, you know, you're a guy who, I'm sure, on a game-to-game basis understands the value of focusing on the opponent that's standing on the other sideline. But you're also a guy that's been around the game for a long time, and you know kind of the size and scope of that aura. What is your opinion of just kind of, you know, how that impacted Yale and what they were able to do?
Well, I think looking at the beginning of that game was telling. You know, I thought Yale came out and they were extremely tight, and, you know, kind of played that way a little bit. You know, obviously Syracuse jumps out to a 4-0 lead, and, you know, it just seemed like Yale wasn't doing the things that they are, you know, that they typically do, that they've done all year long. And I think that happens to some teams, you know, when you're not on that stage consistently. I just think it's tough to just show up and do what you do. And, you know, I always say this to our teams, no matter what stage it is, you know, that the bigger the stage, the quicker you have to settle into what you've always done. And I thought Syracuse did a better job of that, and Yale didn't. You know, that said, you know, Yale recovered and they came back in a big way. You know, after going down, you know, 4-0, you know, they scored the game's next six goals, and you know, I thought that was really impressive. They did a nice job. They controlled tempo, you know, really until about 3.5 minutes left in the game, and you know, at that point, it was just Syracuse time. You know, it's amazing, you know, to watch, and you know, you're almost ready to give up on them. And then, you know, Kevin Rice comes up with that huge goal, and you know, like, okay, here they come. And lo and behold, you know, they turn into one of the top teams in the country again in the final 3 minutes. And I just think that's part of the deal with Syracuse when you talk about, you know, having that capital S. It is. And I feel like it's, you know, the kids that go to Syracuse, they believe that they're going to win a national championship every single year. That said, you know, this particular group, you know, hasn't been anywhere close to it. So, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see how they show up in the Final Four and if they're able to, you know, play like they did in the middle part of that game, which was basically a non-existent team, or they play how they did at the beginning and at the end, which is the Syracuse of old. So I think from a Syracuse standpoint, you know, they got to feel really happy about how they come out with that win. I don't think they played necessarily well. I think a lot of that had to do with Yale. You know, Yale, it was just a great matchup for Syracuse, especially on the defensive end versus the Syracuse offense. You know, they have such, you know, a veteran presence due to the Elis on the defensive end. You know, they always have that X factor, you know, at the faceoff dot where, you know, Dylan Levings, you know, he could just go off and win 6-7 in a row. And I think that's something that made them feel very comfortable all year long. So I think when you look at this game, you know, I think a lot of people around the country were surprised it was so tight late. You know, they look at it and say, all right, well, you know, you have unseeded Yale, you have number one seeded Syracuse, this should be a blowout. But, you know, not so fast. I thought it was an excellent game. And, you know, I just I look at the way that Yale kind of finished this season, and, you know, it's a testament to their coaching staff and their senior leaders. They had great leadership all year long, and they truly believed that they could go in and beat Syracuse, and that's why it was a one-goal game.
Just in terms of how you kind of manage a game like this as a coach where, you know, 20 saves, 13 goals, 3 penalties, it just seems like one of those games that kind of went by quickly and there wasn't a whole lot in it until the last couple minutes. Is that something that, like, I don't know, have you ever been a part of a game where you felt like that was going on in the moment, or is it just something that kind of you look up and you're like, oh man, we're halfway through the fourth quarter already?
No, it's part of, actually, it's the Patriot League is known for that. You know, you look at the Patriot League games over the course of the year, you know, most games are not getting into the double digits. And, you know, typically it's because teams are defending the other team extremely well. And, you know, when you know teams as well as you do in the Patriot League, and I would say the same, you know, mantra goes in the Ivy League, you know, you know the team inside and out. So when you're getting stops and, you know, there's no penalties, there's no fouls, there's no goals, really, the game just flies by. And, you know, you could go for stretches where there's, you know, 15, 20 minutes without a goal. There's no penalties, there's no stoppages, and there's no timeouts. So, yeah, the game just flies by. And I think for Yale, that means that the game was being played at their pace, you know, because they were getting stops. You know, the only time that the play was stopping in the middle of this game was when they were scoring goals. You know, Syracuse scored, you know, in the first quarter with 1:22 left, and then they didn't score again until, you know, 3:04 left in the fourth quarter. So, you know, I think the second and third quarter in particular, the game just flew by, and that was the Yale's benefit.
It's interesting because it, you know, kind of puts into the context of, like, it just doesn't seem like there was a whole lot there. You know what I mean? So that as you parlay forward with what is Syracuse and who are they going to be, you know, in their Final Four matchup, you know, my opinion is that they're a very chameleon-type team. And it's uncommon, I think, for Syracuse, who in so many fans' eyes has a very clear identity. You know, Syracuse is a team, to me, that can play any number of different ways, and I think that is one of their advantages. And I guess, you know, it's especially pertinent in the context of, you know, the next game I want to talk about, which is the first game on Sunday, and that is, you know, a Denver team that fell behind 6-1 or 6-0? I get confused between theirs and
6-0. 6-0.
Yeah, so, and then, you know, they're able to chip away and chip away and chip away, and it's, you know, in some ways similar to what Ohio State wasn't able to do, in some ways similar to what Yale was able to do. But ultimately, you know, just to quickly finish my point about Syracuse, you know, they're playing a Denver team that was able to come back, you know, beat North Carolina in a 1-goal game. But I think Denver is a team that has a very, very strict identity. And what you saw in the first quarter was them being taken out of their identity and having to adjust. You know, and I think a lot was made of their transition defense, and I think rightfully so. I thought it was, you know, it cost them 4 or 5 goals, and it cost them a ton of momentum in the early going. The thing that surprised me the most about that was that they had been such a strength for Denver over the last, you know, year or two, because of their, you know, kind of glut of two-way middies that they were able to rely on in the offensive end, that they were able to do so many other things in the you know, in between in the transition game, and also defensively and through injuries, and, you know, kind of not having a ton of offensive options now. I think that they've, you know, realized that, you know, you got to kind of change their style a little bit, and, you know, that's, It was, you know, part and parcel to their poor start. But ultimately, on the other end, you know, I thought that North Carolina, once they stopped getting their transition goals, just didn't have a good enough plan of attack for being able to go at Denver's poles. You know, I would have liked to have seen them dodge with you know, particularly, you know, Joey Sankey and Marcus Holman, who I felt like in a lot of ways, you know, were very quiet. Maybe artificially quiet. Didn't necessarily see them getting turned back as much as I saw turnbacks in the Yale Syracuse game. Just thought that they were dodging, they were starting their dodges from, you know, spots that are unfamiliar or uncommon for them. You know, I think that, you know, when I think of Joey Sankey bombing to the goal, he's starting, you know, basically in the coffin corner all the way back, you know, maybe even outside the box, and just taking a run at his guy. And he didn't see a lot of that, in my opinion, and I wasn't exactly certain as to why. You know, and I guess kind of, When you're not getting the types of offensive possessions that you need to get, in my opinion, in the second half, plus the fact that you're getting, you know, really well handled at the faceoff X, I believe Chase Guerra finished up 17 for 25. It's kind of the way the game's going to shake out. Was there anything, you know, kind of dramatic outside of that that stuck out to you?
Yeah, I think, you know, this game was a tale of two halves. You know, I think that was very obvious. You know, you talk about Denver's transition defense, you know, they didn't help themselves by running a lot of people out of the game early on, and, you know, that's kind of atypical of Denver. You know, typically they'll keep a guy or two on, you know, defeat the transition, and then get people on or get people off, you know, through the midline or through the box and in the sub game. And I think you know, they made that adjustment at halftime. You know, that helped them out a little bit, but, you know, I think a lot of that has to do with North Carolina. I mean, I saw that firsthand. You know, that's how they make their living. I mean, they run and gun, defense to offense. You know, you saw, you know, four of their first, you know, 6 goals were in transition. Obviously, one, you know, just kind of bonehead on Denver, trying to make that Denver switch and not telling the offensive guys, or make the goalie switch and not telling the offensive guys that you're doing it. So, you know, they didn't help themselves out, and I think they realized that. But I do think a lot of that had to do with North Carolina. You know, in the second half, you know, the thing for me, you know, looking at, all right, well, you know, why is North Carolina out of sync? Well, they didn't have the ball. You know, you look at what was going on. Carolina was still pushing it. You know, Mark McNeil scored another goal in transition, which, you know, it's great when you get that. But it's not an opportunity to play 6v6. You know, they had a couple of turnovers in transition on the clear, and you don't get to play 6v6. And by the way, you're not winning any faceoffs in the second half. So I'm going to say that, you know, they had single-digit possessions where they actually played 6v6, you know, half-field offense in the second half. And I don't care what team you are, you could have Marcus Holman, Joey Sankey, or, you know, Joe Schmo and whoever else. You know, you don't have the ball, you're going to be out of sync. And I think that was the case for the North Carolina offense in the second half. And they didn't help themselves either. I mean, they went to the penalty box a bunch in the second half, and Denver scored 3 extra man goals. You know, so you're up 9-4 at halftime, and you come out and you foul a bunch of times, and 2 of them were attackmen, you know, drawing fouls. You know, one was a slash, and the other one was a hold in the fourth quarter. And, you know, Denver is just deadly on the extra man. So, you know, they go 3 for 3. And, you know, it's like, you know, foul shots in basketball. You know, the clock's not moving and you get free points. You know, it's kind of the same thing with the extra man when you foul Denver. And I thought that allowed them to creep closer, get some confidence, and eventually they were able to tie it up and get the game winner. So, you know, I thought, you know, Denver certainly played hard in the second half. They played better, but I think Carolina really, really let this one slip by playing the way that they did.
The point that I was starting insofar as Denver's identity is, and I thought that they did a better job defensively in their support, even though I made the comment that I didn't see as many turnbacks as maybe I did in other games. It was maybe part and parcel to your other point about single digit possessions in the second half, but to me Denver is a team that. First of all, because they are so efficient offensively, I think that this misperception exists and perpetuates that they play very fast, that they score a lot of goals in transition. And I think that they used to score a fair amount of goals off the faceoff, and I don't think they're really trying to do that much anymore. They aren't nearly as aggressive in their
face. Chase has been banged up. That
right.
hurts him, when he's banged up and, he's playing at like 75% right now. So for him to push it forward and get some edges that way has been really, really challenging for him. So I think that that plays a factor. Sorry to cut you off.
No, not at all. But it's a really good point. And for a guy who used to take draws, and I would imagine like to have a pretty offensive posture when doing so. I thought that Denver in primarily in 2011 was so unique in putting Flint Noble on the wings and maybe even putting him above the opposing wings in anticipation that Chase was going to win it forward and they were going to be able to push into maybe even a 6-on-3, 6-on-4 type situation, albeit rare, still very powerful when you're able to. Now I think that they've in their faceoff posture have worked very hard to isolate it to a Chase Carrero versus whomever he's playing against and boxing out the wings type posture. I don't think that they are super concerned about giving up goals off the faceoff. And as a result, I think that they, care a lot less about scoring goals off the faceoff. And I do agree with you that it's because of his health. But I think that, the way that that has parlayed itself into just the average length of their offensive possessions, they are so good at keeping the timer off, which I think is, slowly becoming a skill, meaning that they're able to appear as if they're being aggressive and yet still working 90-second possessions, wearing down defenses and getting good looks. It really is a kind of a remarkable thing. And then how that kind of has affected them defensively is, to your point, I think they are a team that works very hard to not play a ton of defense. Their defense was criticized, regularly throughout the season as being a weakness. And I think that, for Coach T, who I would imagine doesn't like hearing that very much, I think he and his staff did a really nice job of finding what in the short term was a really nice solution. And I think that what you've seen happen is the emergence of, some of their on-ball defenders. And I think Carson Cannon is the type of player who's going to start to get a lot more credit for his ability to stay in front of guys. And then obviously one of the unique things about the identity of this team is their two goalie situation. And, I made the point on Sunday that I thought that the reason that they changed out for Foss was because he is more of a helter-skelter player. And that was a helter-skelter game. And I felt vindicated in making that point in the moment because I thought that the saves that he made in the second quarter, still were in that mode. And it was very beneficial for Denver to try to quell some of what Carolina had going, and kind of possess themselves. But those first quarter turnovers that either led directly to goals or led to possessions that resulted in goals, very uncharacteristic for Denver. And I think that, I guess that's kind of my point. Like, in a Denver-Syracuse matchup, you're going to see Denver want to play one way, and they're going to work hard to make that game play out that way. And I don't think that you see that as much out of Syracuse, a team that I think can play a handful of different ways, high scoring, low scoring, play a lot of defense, play a little bit more offense. And that's one of the things about this matchup that excites me so much.
Yeah, I think, a lot to react there. I'm not a huge fan of the platoon system in the goal, and I was pretty adamant about that when I was on TV. And you know, I thought making the switch was good. You know, for me, you know, no disrespect to Ryan LaPlante, I think he's a good goalie. I think Jamie Fowles is better, and you know, we played against both those guys this year earlier in the year, and you know, we scored a bunch of goals in the first half against LaPlante, and you know, got shut down in the second half against Fowles. So maybe I'm a little bit biased there, but to me, you know, obviously, you know, who am I to tell Coach Tierney what to do? But I think you just go with Jamie Fowles, and you know, I think when you get to this point in the year, you got to pick a hot goalie and you got to go with him and ride it. And you know, not that you have to stick with him; he's not doing well, but that would be my choice at this point. And you know, I agree with you in that specific game. I thought that was a Jamie Fowles type game, so you know, he came in and he did a nice job. He made the saves he was called on to make, so that was a good thing for Denver. You know, as far as their offense is concerned. I mean, I've said this a number of times, that they're absolutely surgical in the half-field 6v6 offense. And they have all the parts that you would want to be a great half-field offense. You know, they have very, very good dodgers that can initiate and get the defense to rotate. And if you don't rotate, they can just shoot the ball on the run and score. And, you know, one of the most underrated players on that team, in my opinion, is Eric Adamson. And, you know, he was relatively quiet in the scoring column. In the playmaking column in general until the end of that game when he, you know, scored the big goal, you know, coming down the alley, and then obviously, you know, tried to stuff that one in at the end and you know, rebound over to Law. But, you know, he's been a very underrated player in my opinion. You know, they got inside guys, you know, Gordy Korber and, you know, Colin Scott that can finish the ball. You know, Westberg, you know, is a little inside-outside matchup nightmare. You know, he's got range, but he can finish like the best of them inside. You know, you got Law behind the goal who can facilitate, you know, catch, feed. He can score some as well. You know, you got, you know, Flint and Noble. Yeah, it's just, you know, you got guys all over the place that just, you know, different attack points, you know, with depending on what the defense is doing. You can't really zone them because they're so skilled. And you play man-to-man and you press them a little bit, they have guys that can run by you. So there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, Denver, they'll push it if they have to or if it calls for it. But for the most part, they just want to settle it down and then start picking you apart. And you know, that's where they're going to make their living. I think if they can get possession, the face-off battle will be huge. And I know a lot has been made for Syracuse that they've lost face-off battles and won games and, you know, that was a big deal. But, you know, to me, that's, you know, you're walking a fine line when it comes to that. You know, possession against Denver is key. You want to make sure you have the ball more than they do and significantly more. And I think Syracuse could be in a whole heap of trouble if they're playing a lot of defense against that Denver offense.
I you know, I love the point you make about Berg. To me, the way he's emerged, and it was interesting, I think, you know, all over on the broadcast, you know, people were making mention of how excited the Denver staff was when he arrived. And, you know, I think that a lot of it has to do with his versatility, the types of different things that he can do to be dangerous, you know, whether it's feet set shooting from, you know, 10 to 14 yards. You know, he can score moving. You know, I wouldn't say that he's a super dangerous threat shooting on the run, but I think that, you know, he was a midfielder coming in, or at least that was where he was projected to play, you know, and certainly has played at points throughout this season, depending on how their personnel is shaken out. You know, to his inside game, and I agree with you insofar as, you know, their surgical nature and the idea that long possessions aren't for the sake of long possessions, but they're for the time it takes to develop a good look. You know, he's been on the kind of receiving end or the beneficiary's end of a lot of those looks. And, you know, very much, I don't want to say a secret weapon, but very much kind of for all that Eric Law does in initiating the offense, I think that, you know, Westberg is the player who, you know, is able to be the catalyst so far. In whatever kind of scientific way those two things are different, you know, that would be the way I try to put my finger on it. But in the interest of time, let's move on to the weekend capper, and that is Duke 12-11 victors over Notre Dame. And, you know, I'm curious from I guess just to kind of set things up, how excited were you for this game, you know, with, you know, your ties to the Duke program as well as, you know, kind of this being a coach's game? There were some fans, I think, that, you know, were kind of like, oh, not again, when it came to Duke-Notre Dame. I'm curious as to what your opinion was in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely a coach's game, and the reason being is, you know, when you play, to me, the matchup that I was most excited to watch was the Duke offense versus the Notre Dame defense. And, you know, Duke offense coming in number three in the country, you know, Notre Dame defense coming in number eight in the country, you know, some of the top units that you're going to see, some of the top personnel you're going to see in the country. So for me as a coach, I was really excited to watch that one. And the coordinators for both of those units are two of the best and brightest in the sport. You know, Ronnie Caputo for Duke coaching the offense, and then Jerry Byrne coaching the defense for Notre Dame. So I was fascinated by that matchup. And, you know, I thought Ronnie Caputo did a nice job of, you know, switching up initiating points against the Notre Dame defense. Me personally, you know, just understanding what they're trying to do on defense, I think the best place to attack that defense is either from behind the goal or it's from the wings. You know, they want you to dodge from up top and dodge the alley. That's when they're most comfortable, and I think they're most uncomfortable coming from the mid to low wings and then behind the goal. And I thought Duke did a nice job of starting the majority of their offense from those spots, and then, you know, getting the ball into the hands of guys like Jordan Wolfe and David Lawson. And the thing that was fascinating to me is that I thought Duke did a nice job of sharing the ball and working for the right looks, but they also had a lot of unassisted goals. And to me, that's very un-Notre Dame defense-like. And I was just, you know, kind of fascinated by that, you know, phenomenon in the game, is that, you know, a bunch of Duke goals were unassisted. So anyway, the point is this, as a Duke alum, obviously I watch with great interest, but as a fan of the sport and as a coach in particular, you know, to watch the inner workings of that matchup were really fun. And, you know, there were so many oddities in that game. You look at it, and I think, you know, Kyle Turry on the other end was, you know, only registered, you know, two saves, at least officially. I think he had three or four in the game, but that's what he had. And, you know, he was struggling all day. Notre Dame offense was clicking, and, you know, he made the biggest save of the day on either end. And, you know, he had to step up at the end and make that save, and it led to transition on the other end. And it was just incredible how that game turned on a dime with that save, and, you know, one that he had to make. And I don't know, you think about saves of the game, you know, the guy on the other end was standing on his head all day. And, you know, I give that kid a lot of credit. You know, John Kemp, he's taken a lot of flack over the last couple of weeks, and deservedly so. You know, his numbers have dipped this year, but, you know, in the biggest game of the year, you know, he was certainly not the reason that Notre Dame lost that game. You know, he kept them in it all the way through, and I thought he was very impressive on the day. So, interesting stuff at the end of the day. I do think the better team won. I don't say that just because I'm a Duke alum. I do think the better team won, and it sets up a monumental matchup with Duke and Cornell. That's going to be fireworks.
Yeah, your point about the unassisted goals that Duke was able to generate, one of the things in doing the anonymous scouting reports that I do every week, that, you know, a coach pointed out to me that, you know, really made my brain kind of spin insofar as, you know, how it made sense and how it reflected what I had seen about teams that had given Notre Dame trouble was, you know, how comparatively susceptible Notre Dame's defense is to two-man games behind, because as this coach put it, it puts them in between their rules, meaning, you know, do they want to switch on their picks? Do they want to fight through? You know, typically they want to switch on picks. They don't care about matchups, but if it's, you know, a matchup like getting Jordan Wolfe on a short stick, you know, you're supporting that guy maybe even a little quicker than you otherwise would. And, you know, this is a Notre Dame defense that supports a lot. That was what I expected to see, and I didn't really see Duke try to do a lot of it. You know, and the inverse point to that was you're not going to see as much alley dodging, running through, etc., that you might out of other teams against Notre Dame. But that's almost, you know, that's pretty much, you know, there's two or three Dave Lawson goals that stand out as him running through defenders and getting to, you know, the cylinder probably 8 to 10 yards out and cannon nice shots. Now, they were contested shots in a lot of instances, but you're right. It almost came across as, and you hear this from time to time about Duke, you know, they are Duke. They are able to bring in the athletes and the players that they want. And when they're able to do these types of things because they are so athletic and so good and so skilled, you know, it makes it a very difficult matchup. And, you know, I don't necessarily, you know, to your point about the better team winning, I think the easiest way it is to say that Duke is the better team is to say, wow, look at what some of these players are able to do individually. Look at what Luke Dupree was able to do to keep that ball inbounds, to goose it all over, you know, between four and five Notre Dame guys with time running out, come up with possession and work the ball to the offensive end as Duke was able to kill the clock in a one-goal lead. I mean, those are the types of plays that, you know, regardless of who the coach is, you can't count on making because they are just, wow, that kid's a really good player. And, you know, to your point about this matchup as it extends going forward, you know, Cornell has struck out as one of the more athletic teams, and it's not just, you know, it's not just Rob Pinnell and Connor Busick, you know, who are two tremendous athletes in their own right. They are very athletic all across the board. You know, maybe not necessarily as big or as heavy as Duke is in a lot of places on the field, but very good nonetheless. And you're right, it's going to be really exciting to watch in that regard.
Well, there's been a lot of talk this year that maybe the face-off game isn't as important as it used to be with the new rules and possessions and all that type of stuff. Well, I for one think that in this game, Duke versus Cornell, that's going to be huge. I think the face-off battle is going to be monstrous because, you know, the matchup of Brendan Fowler versus, you know, Doug Tesoriero, you know, both those guys are playing great right now and were huge reasons why their teams are at this point. You know, when either offense has the ball on Saturday, I think either offense is going to feel like they can score goals. And, you know, I think they deserve to feel that way. I mean, you know, Duke is one of the top offenses in the country, as is Cornell, and, you know, they have incredible players. I don't think Cornell has anyone that can guard Jordan Wolf. I don't think Duke has anyone that can guard Rob Pinnell. And I think you're going to see the ball in the sticks of those guys all day long. And, you know, as a common fan watching lacrosse, that's pretty cool. Those are two of the best guys in the country. And you're going to see, you know, them trying to make plays all day. And I think that's really exciting for anybody who wants to watch a great game. And, you know, fitting it's going to be the first game of the weekend, I think that one has got potential to be like a 16-15 overtime game, something like that. It's going to be a game of runs, you know, up and down. It's going to be like MLL style. I think back to the game I coached in as an assistant coach, 2007, you know, Duke Cornell, you know, back when, you know, our starting attack was Danowski, Greer, and Quinzani with Crotty running up in the midfield. You know, they had Max Siebold and Johnny Glynn. You know, we run out to 10-4 at halftime or something like that. They come all the way back and, you know, finishes with a Greer goal with 3 seconds left. I think you're going to see that type of a game on Saturday. It should be a lot of fun.
The point you made about the face-off X, and, you know, I'm not a face-off expert, but, you know, Doug Tesoriero strikes me as a very physical face-off guy. And, you know, obviously, Brendan Fowler's background as a football player has been well-documented. This strikes me as the type of face-off battle where both guys are going to make sure that they're wearing real shoulder pads and not, you know, I don't know. Every team calls them something different, but you know what I'm talking about, the white ones that are just like the like, kind of Lycra, essentially.
Yeah, these guys are going to battle. I mean, it's going to be more a wrestling match than it is a lacrosse match. So I think it'll be fun. Yeah, I think it'll be fun. It's going to be you know, it's going to be an up and down, you know, type of game. So I think you'll see a lot of face offs. So I think you know, if you're looking at runs, you know, if you know, you play make it take it for any point in the game, you're probably going to have a good chance to take some leads or at least try and chip away at one. So yeah, I think those guys are going to get at it. They're going to battle. I think both of them are going to want to, you know, kind of get low and grind and impose the other, you know, impose their will on the other person. So I think wing play might come into play as well. And you know, you have some of the best wing play that you're going to see in the country. some of the best long sticks. You know, you look at Luke Dupree for Duke. You know, that guy's an absolute stud. You got Keith on the other end who's, you know, picking up ground balls at an incredible clip. So I just think it's an absolute, you know, dream of a matchup when you look at it from an athletic standpoint, toughness. You know, you got stardom on both ends of the field offensively. You got goalies that are going to have to bring it. That's going to be the X factor in this game. You know, I don't think either goalie is playing terrifically right now. You got one guy who's been there a little bit, you know, more. He's an older guy, upperclassman, at, you know, for Cornell and Fiore. Then you got a guy, Terry, who's never been there. So I think one of those guys stepping up could actually be the difference in the game.
Awesome. Well, Kevin Cassis, excellent breakdown of quarterfinal weekend, and certainly plenty of preview looking ahead into Final Four. We appreciate your time. What's your Final Four plan?
Final Four plan, I will be down there on Saturday. I'll be at the site in Philly, be doing a little bit of work for ESPN and a little bit of hanging out, watching the games with my family. So I'm looking forward to enjoying the weekend. It should be a great one.
Awesome. Well, enjoy yourself. You know, good luck, break a leg as you appear on camera. Thanks again for your time, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon, bud.
All right. Thanks, Terry.
Inside the Cross Podcast.